Mega. Mega. Rebooting.
Know what Mega City One is,
Dre. Hi guys, and welcome to this episode of The Cyber Show. We are joined today by Mega Kumar.
Hello, I'm Mega Kumar. I serve as Chief Product Officer and Head of Geopolitical Risk at CyXL.
Okay, we've got a lot to cover today. Mega Kumar is a cross-disciplinary thinker. She comes from a background in history, journalism, and political science. Today, we're going to be talking about the challenges to creating a joined-up and grown-up conversation on digital technology. Why do people find it so hard to talk about digital tech, to form meaningful democratic opinions, to make policy and work together to make a humane digital world? Welcome to the show, Mega.
Thank you very much, Andy. Delighted to be here.
Would you tell us a little bit about how you got to be here today working on digital policy and cyber resilience?
Yeah, well, it's been an interesting journey through here. I started my career some 20-odd years ago as a journalist in Delhi and then as a gender historian at Oxford, where I did my doctorate. And what was apparent throughout my stint at The Statesman and The Telegraph in Delhi and then at Oxford, examining sort of sexual violence and ethnic conflict, was how interconnected everything is. You know, while we require specialization, whether it's on political science or history or gender or public policy, all of these are complex human societal issues. And in order to diagnose what is happening in society, both good and bad, to sort of help advance solutions, whether via public policy or collective action in the public sphere, all these sort of tackling these issues requires one to think across boundaries. Specialization is important and sort of, you know, following one thread, as it were, of analysis through from top to bottom is important. But it's important always to remember that one thread doesn't make a tapestry of society. And that gradually led me into the world of political risk. I was with a company called Oxford Analytica, which was a pioneer in geopolitical risk analysis. I led their Asia practice for many years and then established their cybersecurity and technology practice, because by the middle of, you know, 2010s, it was apparent what a decisive shift we were looking at in terms of the innovation in the field of technology, you know, whether it was cloud or NFTs, then more recently, obviously, AI and blockchain. That these technologies were going to have a profound impact, not just on specific sectors of the economy, but actually the global economy and therefore the global political economy and society. So following those multiple interlocked threads is what led me here to what I'm doing today.
I think we've come into a period of time where risk is changing very rapidly. From my perspective, as someone in their 50s, having been through the Cold War from the 80s onward, that actually feels like a period of real stability and that kind of mutually assured destruction of the old superpowers now looks like a period of great peace and tranquility. How much do you think that the global risk situation has hotted up, just as your personal opinion?
You know, the benefit of being an historian, really, by training, is that, you know, you start thinking through long arcs of history. And it is true that if you look at some certain sections of history, you know, let's say, you know, you mentioned the Cold War, so you're essentially looking at what's happened in the world in the last sort of 70 years after the end of the Second World War, you know, things can look a little bit tumultuous now compared to that time. But people who lived through that time would not characterize that period as calm. You know, hindsight has that great benefit of making the past look always slightly better, slightly easier to navigate than the future that lies ahead of us. But, you know, the 20th century was an extremely turbulent time. So if you just, you know, go back two generations instead of one, the First World War and the Second World War obviously were hugely dramatic, violent, and decisive moments for the world. But equally, we had in the last 100 years alone, two very dramatic ideologies rise and fall. So socialism and fascism. We saw the peak of colonization across large parts of the global south. And then, you know, from the 1950s onwards, huge waves of decolonization, which fundamentally shaped Latin America, large parts of the African continent, and obviously Asia Pacific. So are we looking at a more tumultuous time now than 100 years ago? I think that would not be accurate.
That's very interesting. And that's nice to hear, because let's throw away some of the doom and gloom and take a long view on some of these things. It's very parochial thinking that we always don't have that long view of history. And especially with so much in the media now and so much information, it seems to be a very hot time, as Marshall McLuhan would say. So your particular area of interest, Mega, is in cyber and looking at how digital technologies have changed the way that the world works. And our kind of take on it is that things aren't going well in the digital world. We're always trying to find positive messages and to try and create a more humanist, positive view of technology. But many of the ways that digital technologies developed have kind of gone wrong. From this very idealistic period, perhaps in the late 70s, early 80s, with the emergence of the internet. And lots of things haven't worked out quite how we hoped they would have done. So by analogy, my father-in-law is one of the original Kyoto scientists. They're at the foundation of environmentalism. And when we talk about current events and, well, the current mess, him as a biochemist and me as a computer scientist, we share this same sense of disappointment and frustration about the impossibility of being heard and of science having still being able to have a meaningful impact. Ignoring experts isn't something that just started with Trump and modern populism. It's kind of maybe it's a bit of our nature. If you're up against global industrial populist propaganda machine, how on earth do people who are capable of understanding and helping create a more humane world engage and get their message out?
Yeah, well, Andy, that was a very rich tapestry of ideas. Let me sort of share some thoughts on parts of what you said. You know, starting with technology, I mean, you know, one of the most fundamental principles of any kind of technological innovation is that we have to remember nothing is risk-free. No technology is risk-free. And, you know, and it can start from something as basic as a hammer. It wouldn't take a lot of imagination to do what kind of bad things one could do with a hammer, as opposed to all the good stuff that a hammer can do. The same was true, for example, over the last 150 years with railways, right? It connected huge sort of unconnected populations. It led to the emergence of the hinterland. It led to the emergence of small towns, of metropolitan cities. It connected people, services, goods, ideas across continents, across countries. At the same time, however, if you want to look at railways from its negative perspective, the emergence of a railway network across large swathes of former colonies, such as the Indian subcontinent, for example, or large parts of Latin America, it was precisely the railways that also facilitated the colonial program, the plundering of agricultural land, the erosion of local industry, the exploitation of the raw materials base of the colonized world. So in a way, it's not the technology per se that is risk-prone or risk-free. It more depends on the intention with which that technology is developed, what kind of stakeholders get to control the development, the deployment, the decommissioning of that technology, what kind of sort of dialogue exists between whether it's the government versus the citizens or the consumers that get affected and the people who control capital. And if you look at it from that lens, social media is not very different from that. AI is not very different from that. Cloud is not very different from that. Or if you go back one generation of technology, mobile phones are not very different. Where there is a major departure in terms of the risk we face, that is, as you rightly pointed out, in the field of climate change. Now, that is one truly global risk. You know, floods will have no respect for geographical boundaries, for wealth, for the nicety of different cultures. Where we are failing as a society is to have that global conversation, because the only way you can solve a problem like climate change is by having a global conversation. And unfortunately, the geopolitics of the world and its various economic frameworks are running in the opposite direction. And I think that is a truly major risk. It's also an unprecedented risk. We've been talking about climate change as a society for a good 100 years. This is not new. We have been talking about environmental degradation, chemical-related pollution for many, many years. But at a global level, this has obviously become a conversation since Kyoto. We have had successive summits since then to talk about it. But what we get is platitudes, because the fundamental will to change, and all of us will need to change to more or less extent, that will is simply not there, because we're all short-termist. As a society, as humans, we are short-termist. We tend to underestimate long-term risks. We overestimate near-term risks. And policymakers, you know, if you're operating in a democratic society, the average term of a government is 4 to 6 years, depending on what the specific parliamentary term of a country looks like. So, you know, nobody has the incentive to think beyond 6 years or four years. And that is precisely the wrong place to start when it comes to something like climate. And the related point about this is that climate mitigation is a global conversation. It's not happening. Climate adaptation is a risk that is already here. You know, over the last few years, we have seen extreme weather events everywhere, from flooding to droughts to hurricanes, you know, on and on the list goes. Adapting to the changes in our biosphere is not an option anymore. We just have to do it. We have to build our infrastructure, keeping that in mind. We have to build our services and goods supply chain, keeping that in mind. We have to think about how we build our homes and key infrastructure like hospitals and schools, keeping that in mind. That is just the reality of the world we have created over the last 200 years.
It is. It's a very stark reality. And I think, we start to bring psychology and we bring sociology and things like that into it. And from a psychology point of view, there's a huge amount of denial. There's, you know, people, the things that are so terrifying that nobody really wants to face them or contemplate them. You mentioned will. And I'm interested in this relationship between will and motivation. I'd like to push back a little bit on this idea that we're short-term thinkers. I don't think as human nature we are short-term thinkers, from the fact that we invest so much love and thought in our children and grandchildren and things. So I think as human beings, we are long-term thinkers. We're capable of thinking about history going back thousands of years, and we're capable of imagining different futures possibly going forward hundreds or thousands of years. But when it comes to the structures that run society, the capital and the motivations, you're absolutely right. Everything is structured on a kind of next quarter horizon. And that is something that somehow we absolutely need to change. That I really, really agree with that. Yes. And you mentioned complexity as well. I know this is something that's close to your heart, dealing with unpacking how people relate to complexity, not by retreating from it or simplifying things, but how do we embrace an ever more complex and difficult world? And another thing that seems to be pushing in the opposite direction is now with AI, there's an enormous dumbing down going on, in which understanding and contemplation and deep discussion is just not fashionable anymore. Everyone wants a quick answer. They want it right now, and they want something else to make their decisions for them. Do you recognize that?
Well, to a degree, but not wholly. AI is many things, and it has become fashionable to sort of see AI as the ultimate sort of source of boom in the world and doom, you know, so as if the truth will not lie somewhere in between. It always does, you know, so I think the hype cycle on the negative side and the positive cycle will soon settle. One of the things that I think as a society we are not paying sufficient attention to is the huge impact AI is going to have on the social contract, by which I mean that over the last 200 years, you know, in most parts of the world, there has been an understanding, an acknowledgement, or an expectation, if you will, that we will all get a good education and we'll have good health. And with that, we can create some kind of job security. And that'll sort of enable every generation to be slightly wealthier, slightly healthier than the previous one. And on this cycle will go. AI, because of its ability to threaten the knowledge-based economy that we have built over the last 50 years, means that not just the working class, you know, the old-fashioned working class in a sort of Marxist way of thinking about class, that got threatened by automation and industrialization over the last 200 years. That's happened everywhere in the world. Some countries deindustrialized after automation, some countries decentralized prematurely, even before their manufacturing base had developed. Now you have a whole advent of a technology that is very cheap or free, can scale very simply, can be used very easily, and its power in terms of its capabilities is just rising exponentially. Even if we reach a plateau in terms of technological advancement in the next 4 or 5 years, it is still hugely spectacular in terms of the capabilities of the various AI models, which in turn means that the knowledge economy of doctors and lawyers and cybersecurity professionals and policymakers and writers and the lot, we all face a new kind of uncertainty. Because if there is a shrinkage of jobs in manufacturing because of automation, there is a shrinkage of services employment because of new AI tools, and let's say the next iteration will be embodied AI, so actually, you know, smart robots who can actually sort of solve problems in a way that industrial robots can't, then the only recourse left in the current economic model is going back to agriculture. And that has been a very shrinking share of the global employment base for years. And it makes sense because automation in agriculture has allowed us to feed a planet of nearly 8 billion people. So where does that then lead the social contract upon which our political societies are formed?
Very good question. I'm going to frame it in a challenging and interesting way, I hope. Is one of the great risks that we face that our technologies can be too successful, that we become victims of success? And just to put that into a bit of a context, you know, that there is this collapse problem to do with resilience, to do with sustainability, in which a society, it's not merely that the social contract maintains expectations, it maintains the ability of technology to continue and to develop. So we educate people ostensibly so that they can have employment, so they can go and work in the various sectors of industry producing things. But the side effect of education is that we're able to maintain a newer sphere, a knowledge ecology, which sustains the technology that's carrying us along. And there's a point past which, you know, when we lay back on our laurels and say, great, you know, everything's automated, we can just be lazy and dependent now, suddenly we realize 2 or 3 or 4 generations of people who know how things work, who can repair things, who can truly innovate, because there's no evidence, you know, that there's no evidence at all of genuine innovation, of genuine understanding. It's certainly something that Roger Penrose, I think, nailed really well. That, you know, and once we're trapped in this into a cycle, we kind of get into a bubble where our horizons disappear. And if something goes wrong at that point, we're done. We're absolutely cooked, because we cannot continue, and we can't even induct ourselves. We have a sort of what's called a black start problem. We don't know how to smelt the iron to make the things to build the power station that could bring everything back online. This seems like a huge existential risk, like more than sort of superb general AI, or it seems that like our technology could be too successful, and in, unless we're able to sort of moderate that success, the success will be the end of us.
This is very interesting. And I've thought about sort of, you know, technology and its impact on society for a very, very long time. And oddly, as a gender historian, because, you know, one of the things that I discovered during my academic research was the impact of premature deindustrialization in Western India on communal interreligious relations. And, you know, the point that you raised about, you know, could our technology become so successful that we actually become victims of it? That has always been the case. It has always been the case that technology creates winners and losers. And what matters is two things. One, do we as a society or as a polity recognize who the losers are and put remedial measures in place for that affected community? And time again, that's actually not happened. So all the labor force of the world that would have previously been absorbed by manufacturing has actually now become lower end services workers in most parts of the world. So that victim class of technology has not been catered to in a way that they deserve to be. You know, it's happened in some countries better than others. So China, for example, has done a better job than hugely populated countries like India. But on the whole, it's been problematic. And that is one of the reasons why, for example, Trump's appeal to the former Rust Belt in America worked, right? Because those industrial workers could not find a new home for themselves and their social identity, sense of purpose, a pathway to upward social mobility. What do you replace it with? The reason why we are all worried about this latest wave of technology as impact is because the middle class, the white collar workers, the knowledge worker, is going to be deeply affected. We could be the victims of that technology because this is, even in its current early stages of development, AI shows tremendous planning, social engagement skills that up until now we thought were the sole reserve of the cortical canopy of humans. You know, it turns out actually you can code a whole lot of human activity in an AI neural net. So then the question becomes, are we prepared as a society to think about this new huge swathe of victims that could potentially be created from this technology? Yes, that is absolutely a serious risk. I think the existential problems that arise from AI, such as, you know, creation of a new pathogen that could leak out of the most secure biolab in the world and we all perish because of it, you know, that's a perhaps a low probability but high impact risk. You know, that's end times scenario. We mustn't take it lightly.
We'll stay with that one for a moment, Megan. I think that's a topic that I was going to come to later, and it's very, very interesting. It's the containment, knowledge risk, knowledge hazards. Knowledge hazards, I'm sure you've heard of Porton Down.
Yeah.
Those guys there are very, very serious about keeping things that need to be contained, contained, and to make sure that nothing ever leaks out. But when we look at the infosphere, I mean, going back to like 2019, I remember when major data breaches hit the point of being one a week and then almost one a day. Mm. And then they stopped reporting on them. They just disappeared from the news because it was no longer news anymore. Mm. And now I get security bulletins weekly and they list, you know, the top 50 or 100 security breaches. It's just so normalized and so commonplace that, you know, I hate to say it, but, you know, in many ways, cybersecurity is a failed project. And we're really in an absolute hole with it right now for many reasons. But when it comes to strategic limitation of knowledge and things, I think that is a very big risk. And we're absolutely rushing headlong into catastrophe with lots of things. And but I think we need to admit that you really can't keep information. Information really does want to be free. But entropic reasons, right?
I am in command. Obey me and be free.
There are all kinds of great incentives to take risks, right? I mean, if you look at something like drug discovery, you know, inherently there is a incentive to explore around the edges of biochemistry to see if we could potentially unlock new medical treatment, whether it's for viral diseases or Alzheimer's, cancer, you know, as a society, we must take those risks. All research operates on that assumption that good risks are worth taking.
Yep.
And we must explore and operate almost on the most cutting edge of science, where we are not being as responsible as we ought to be, is to sort of understand what we know about the risks. What is it that we could do to mitigate those risks, avoid those risks, and what are risks to tolerate? And with regard to AI specifically, what I find really troubling is that the incentive is primarily commercial, you know, roll out the most recent model and then figure out how to get it right. And that seems to me a completely lopsided way of doing it. And in most current industrial practices, it would be horrifying. Imagine if a pharma company decided, let's actually build a new pill, let's give it to 1 million children, and if they die, then we will roll it back.
I haven't even finished testing it on animals, let alone people.
Then now's your chance.
When?
Tonight.
That's really what happened with social media. I mean, obviously, when drugs like thalidomide and things like that caused the devastation that they did, that was a very unexpected side effect. And most things that you see in pharmaceuticals, the problem that they really have is there's so much testing to go through. It makes things a very long time to market. But in a way, I think Silicon Valley became a cult that turned the entire world into a playground with no ethical oversight, in which we've just tried things and put them out there. And when we do that, because of the connectivity of the network, they're just instantly everywhere at once. Hmm. One of the ways I'd like to just reframe this a little bit, something you said earlier reminded me of Ursula Franklin's concept of prescriptive versus holistic technologies. Mm-hmm. And that in a holistic technology, that everybody is the stakeholder. We're all stakeholders in technology. Whereas through capital and specialization, we've got an ever smaller and smaller and smaller pool of people who potentially benefit enormously financially. And maybe the benefit side of the risk might accrue evenly over the whole world. We'd hope that technology brought us nice things that made life better. But what has in fact happened is that there are many things that people don't want from technology, but they get. So, we do lots of surveys. We talk to lots of people, kids, all ages, occupational classes, teachers, doctors, bricklayers, students, and we get this common thing that we notice. So people do not like surveillance capitalism. They do not like being spied on and tracked. They don't want that. They don't like that. And they hate it about technology. They don't like being lied to and manipulated. They hate that. They do not like that about technology, and they don't want to put up with it. And increasingly, identity and the insecurity of societies, whether you trace that back to immigration or employment or whatever, but having to prove their identity for bloody everything, to buy a Mars bar at the shop, it's like, papers, please. People don't like that. They don't want that. So what we see is many, they seem like low risk things, but they are constantly encroaching on quality of life. So although we may take big risks when we get big positive things, but they are not distributed evenly. And the net effect of all of these small negatives is driving us crazy.
I want you to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. My life has value. I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
We've got mental illness, we've got depression, we've got loneliness. How do we factor in this holistic stakeholder view of the risks and benefits of technology, not just for the big winners like Elon Musk?
Yeah, with regard to the tech ecosystem, the problem is perhaps even more acute than previous iterations of technology, because it's literally about 70 or 80 companies across the world that control the entire AI-related ecosystem. And that is a frighteningly small number for a technology that is so impactful in terms of its scale, breadth, and depth. The UK's Competition and Markets Authority had done a report last year. It was written in the typical sober government style, but anybody who was paying attention to the words on that page would have been truly horrified with the kind of ultra tech capitalism that we are marching into.
I don't like the sound of that.
Neither do I.
All I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
Where we are failing is governments have to take the appropriate responsibility for regulating this tech in all the ways that matter, not regulation in the narrow sense, but controlling and regulating the overall ecosystem in its entirety. And in that, successive governments are failing us. The US, obviously the most technologically powerful country, has the largest tech companies on the planet, both in social media, cloud, and now AI. That's literally a wild west when it comes to regulation. Whereas the EU, in its effort to preserve and protect the rights of its citizens, has made tremendous efforts on data privacy, Digital Markets Act, Digital Services Act, now most recently the AI Act. None of these acts have an opposite number in the United States, even though it is the most powerful, the most well-resourced financially, and it's also the largest digital market.
I don't want to get dragged into the long grass on America because it's just tragic and it's just so sad, but I'd love to hear what your opinion is on India. How is regulation working out there?
Well, again, you can look at it as half glass full or half glass empty. Global South countries, and India included, are caught between a rock and a hard place where they have very serious growth and prosperity needs, whether it's on key things like health, education, yeah, food security. These are not nice to haves. These are fundamental things that the society depends on. And in turn, that means investment in not just fancy technologies, but it requires investment in infrastructure, which will be powered by fossil fuel. It requires investment in, you know, fundamental sectors of ammonia, cement, steel, plastics. That is what makes common infrastructure. And no country, whether it's India or Brazil or South Africa, Indonesia, to say nothing of the slightly more poorer ones, can shy away from that harsh reality. With regard to technological and digital regulation, India is making a lot of effort. There is a law on data privacy. There are regulations emerging on AI. But again, the balance between appeasing the business community and the authoritarian leanings of the current Indian government and the rights of the citizens are sort of almost in conflict with each other. And, you know, as I mentioned to you, Andy, I was in Delhi last week, and coincidentally, the AI summit hosted by the Indian government was taking place in the city at the same time. And the who's who of the tech world were in attendance. You know, from what was promising about the summit was the willingness and desire of emerging economies such as India to take a central role in the conversation about AI. It is right that countries such as India should be at the front and center or at the table, at the top table, not just because of the power of the economy in terms of GDP, but also in terms of the population, in terms of its expertise in the tech sector and the presence of the Indian diaspora everywhere in the tech world. I mean, Sundar Pichai is an Indian immigrant to the United States. What was disappointing, however, about the AI summit was the extent to which senior tech leaders got away with platitudes about AI safety.
This is what happened at Bletchley Park, isn't it?
Exactly.
I mean, I'm glad to hear it went maybe a little gone a bit better in India, but Bletchley Park, I think, is widely considered to have been a sham summit, certainly from the British point of view, one in which Keir Starmer was able to sell off bits of British government to big American companies. But I think the conversation is getting more joined up. We're getting a bigger picture, partly because we've had a little bit of time to think about some of these issues. In terms of developing more long-term thinking, approaching the coordination problem. And you said earlier that, you know, at this critical time when we need more coordination, we need common vocabulary, common ways of talking about problems that we face, that everybody's going in opposite directions. That actually we're in a period of fragmentation. And worse than just not being able to talk, we're actually entering into arms races against each other globally.
Yeah.
I think that everyone should be at the table because there's no way to contain. It's like dealing with the virus in the pandemic. You can't, it's going to go everywhere. Mm. So we might as well all just be part of that conversation from early on. Yeah.
Yeah. And you see, the viral example is actually particularly pertinent here because, you know, COVID was not a long time ago, right? We all have very near memories of what that period was like for us. And regardless of how the virus spread, and, you know, I'm just going to park those theories and conspiracy theories to one side because that doesn't matter. What is more interesting is what happened later, right? We as a world realized that this is a fast-spreading airborne virus and our current immunology in terms of our scientific understanding needed to really step up quickly. We needed a new vaccine. We needed to understand the pathology of this virus and come up with a way of limiting mortality, saving lives. And despite all the political dramas, if you will, all around the world, you know, our inability to talk to each other respectfully, and despite all the wars, despite all the political tensions, we were able to a great degree to come together to tackle this existential risk.
There's loads of good lessons and lots of good things to think about from the pandemic. I've always said that. And also, you know, with many traumas, people don't go back and revisit them. And that's why they stay traumas. We don't go and look back and say, hold on a minute, actually, that worked out quite well. And actually, we learned this or that, you know, okay, don't let some private company be responsible for all the PPE so on. But
immediacy. It's the immediacy of the risk that, Andy, that makes the difference. That, you know, if we don't have a virus or sort of appropriate medical protocols in place, our family members will die and our neighbors will die and our colleagues will die and people that are in our community will die, right? There is no more immediate visceral risk that we face, right?
And necessity is the mother of invention. But people worry.
In this case, kind of, you know, immediate destruction of the self and what we see as our own private domain, right? The climate change issue or AI related issues, it's more analogous to the boiling frog thing that, you know, just, you know, because it's slow and it's uneven and slightly hidden, it's so complex that we can afford to. We'll deal with it tomorrow, or we'll leave it to better minds and, you know, maybe some good will come out of this. And, you know, some good will come out of this. There is absolutely no doubt that technological evolution is going to deliver tremendous gains. The question is, at what cost? The question is, to what community? What is the proportion of the winners and the losers? And then our ability to make sure that people who get negatively affected are still nurtured and can live their best lives.
As Ursula Franklin would say, you know, they're stakeholders in a holistic advance of technology. Let's talk about focus and distraction for a moment, because I think this is one of the keys to coordination and getting people to think more long term about risk and benefits. And it does seem that tech, I've got to get out of this habit. I now always say digital tech because it's become fashionable to just say tech. And that is so misleading. You know, you mentioned concrete and ammonia and basic, you know, the thousands of years of technology that aren't the things that we invented in the last 20 years. It has this property of being very parochial. It's almost a closed, incestuous little world of its own. And that everything's a game changer, right? It's full of hyperbole. A minor change in the user interface of an iPhone, that's a paradigm shift. Enthusiasm is nice, but now I find that the tone's a little so parochial, it's a bit childish, to be honest. And, you know, we need to snap out of this into a more grown-up way of situating technology in history with respect to human values, and so that we're thinking, you know, in taking responsibility for things that happen 50, 60 years down the road, rather than just cashing out and pulling a con job like so many oligarch tech bros sort of want to do. You know, that culture of tech has to change. It has to come back into the public sphere somehow as something that we're all engaged and involved in. Have you any ideas about how we might all take more public ownership? Obviously, European digital sovereignty is an opportunity, but do you have any ideas how we might get there?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of us have to own our power, actually. And I think and this starts at the individual level, but also it can sort of metastasize into bigger communities, whether it's of people who live in close proximity to each other or as organizations or colleagues or societies and polities. Because what are digital technologies based on, right? If you look at the last 3 years of AI, right? Just if you look at that very, very narrow lens, what is AI made up of? Put the hardware to one side. It's based on the data that you and I have put on the internet, right? We have assumed for some reason that the technology that is being sold back to us, whether via social media or latest ChatGPT version, is somehow developed by this group of technologists in Silicon Valley with no relation to us. But actually, if there was a proper data tax where a company such as Anthropic or OpenAI, whatever, had to compensate the people whose data has been instrumental in the emergence of that technology, then the situation will very quickly change.
Absolutely, that you're aware of what's being sold back to you.
Exactly.
I suddenly had a thought of Fight Club and the Paper Street Soap Company with Tyler Durden selling people's own fat back to them as soap. Yeah.
Exactly.
I am Jack's complete lack of surprise.
If there was, and you know, some serious technologists like Jérôme Lanier have made a very clear case on this. If we are going to be affected by such technologies to such a great extent, we need to reclaim back our power. And that power has to do with the data that we generate, which is then repackaged, modulated, and then packaged back into some new tool and sold back to us. Or it's got to do with the security guardrails that we must insist exist on those technologies, especially with regard to misuse of AI and children's data or creation of graphic imagery. We are allowing that kind of techno-capitalism to become more empowered and control our future. And I think it's just, if we can rally around some of these fundamental issues, we have to break out of that. And the other thing is also about the level at which we as consumers of technology evaluate the benefits. You know, the famous Cambridge economist Hajun Chang made a brilliant argument in one of his books that the washing machine and contraception has had, in terms of technologies, these two things have had a greater impact, positive impact on the world than anything that has come out of the digital tech world in the last 50 years.
Yeah, definitely.
You're listening to The Cyber Show.
And, you know, there is a part of me that agrees with that. It's hard to literally sort of come up with some specific KPIs of measuring the washing machine to ChatGPT and contraception to, nuclear technology or whatever.
Well, both of those examples are very hidden, aren't they? They're hidden within the household and the domain of women.
They are hidden within the family ecosystem for sure, but everybody in the family benefits from that.
Yeah.
And in turn, the community benefits from that when people have greater control of their reproductive health, when people have greater control over the time spent on these chores, right? So the individual benefits, the family benefits, then the community benefits, then the national economy benefits. So you can track the impact of great technologies at that level. And I think we should, just as we now look back at history and look at the good tech and the bad of tech, we should do the same exercise with tech that is coming up. And I think that's why we are seeing greater advocacy groups emerge around social media, especially the impact it's having on minors and young people and their mental health. We're seeing more advocacy from parents and social groups, schools on sort of AI, especially, you know, sort of these apps like Nudify. I mean, it's mind-boggling to me that these kinds of things are allowed to exist in the legal economy of the world.
I know, yeah.
The illegal economy will always do these kinds of things, right? You expect that. Fraudsters and the scammers and the pedophiles and thieves, they will always exist. They always have existed and they have all found ways of harming others. But the fact that they're legal is mind-boggling to me.
It is, absolutely. We're going to be covering that actually in an episode very soon.
So, you know, so then really the question is, like, what are the regulators thinking? Like, you know, what could possibly go wrong? I mean, it's just like a disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah. So these are things that people clearly identify as wrong, immoral, however you want to frame it. And undesirable. So we're looking for ways that people will identify, assert, and exercise their power. And these are good ways forward. I mean, this is all within the domain of what we do in the Cyber Show. This is very much our remit, and amplify things that may bring power back to people to have a voice in technology. Just like to move on to another topic, if I may, and that's the concept of radical transparency.
Yeah.
Because I saw this featured PsyXL's website.
Yeah.
And so radical transparency, everyone loves the idea of radical transparency, but often without questioning what that means. Boundaries are very important. You know, information hiding is the essence of abstraction, right? So what do you think radical transparency means? And bearing in mind things like, would you like radical transparency applied to yourself, by which I mean intrusion and lack of privacy and so on. So transparency for whom, transparency, you know, how and so on. And, you know, it depends on who's doing the looking.
Yes.
Most people would say social contract, government should be radically transparent. You know, it's supposed to serve us according to the social contract. It's, government is the people. And so we should know all about what they're doing. On the other hand, you know, maybe not so much for the individual. And going back to what I said earlier, there is such a thing as strategic limitation of knowledge. Mm. Some things you need to keep your mouth shut about. And this is something that I share with, you mentioned Jean Lanier. This is something that we really share. I get involved, get asked often to participate in things to do with, well, worst case scenario, unconventional warfare and so on. And there came a point, as Lanier said, where he didn't want to participate in those conversations anymore because he just felt it was giving people bad ideas.
Mm.
And how do we decide what everybody should know about and what might be best kept a secret? And this is a big question, and technology is making it a more difficult question, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I think it's a brilliant question, and I'm not going to pretend that I have figured this puzzle out, because both parts of that corporate value that you refer, you know, radical and transparency, they're hugely loaded terms. You know, what does radical mean as opposed to moderate or weak, you know? So what does radical in this context means is a very complicated, deep debate. And then the other part, transparency, about what, to whom, to what extent. So I think the way that Waitman's, which owns PsyXL, understands this is in terms of being as transparent, as open in terms of information sharing as possible with regard to the company's performance, the company's clients, the way we do work, and also sort of internal processes about people having visibility into what others are doing, regardless of hierarchies. You know, so for example, one of the ways that radical transparency manifests itself in day-to-day functions at Waitman's is that almost everybody's calendar is open and can be viewed by others across the company. What needs to remain private for whatever reason can be made private. But the default expectation is that people should be able to see what others are doing, even if they're not directly their peers in terms of corporate hierarchy, because that fosters a sense of joint purpose and allows everybody to feel that they are contributing to the company's work and are accountable for what they're expected to do.
Yeah.
That is the corporate side. But, you know, the larger debate about how radical should we be and what actually radical means in today's world and how transparent should we be. I mean, I sort of sympathize with, and I would sort of echo the position you took or the one that Lanier mentioned, that there is a difference between being transparent and stupid. There is a difference between being open and unwise. There is a difference between being radical and irresponsible. There's no blanket answer to what transparency should mean. So, you know, let me take this, you know, as a thought experiment. If I think about my own life, so I have two small young children, 6 and 8, there is a limit to which I can be transparent to them. Right? Yeah. A, because I would not want to share information that they can't currently process or understand or is age inappropriate or context inappropriate. And there are all kinds of things that I can be very transparent to young people about. Equally, there are all kinds of transparency principles that I can apply when dealing with one client, let's say on some sensitive cyber issue or digital strategy issue. But it would be irresponsible of me to then transparently share that information with another client, you see? So I think the context is always going to be important when we decide how radical we can and should be how transparent we can and should be. You know, transparency and privacy, transparency and security, these are not mutually exclusive things.
No, not at all. And you say decide, and I think choice is absolutely paramount here.
Yes, and how that choice is made, again, is context dependent. You know, certain choices we make as individuals or as members of a family or a community, certain choices are sort of laid out for us in an organizational context where we decide as an organization what we choose to be open or not open about. And that applies to sort of states at the highest level as well. So how those choices come to be, what justifies those choices, and how one choice may need to change in a certain context or evolve with time, all that is context dependent. So just sort of brandishing a label of, you know, we are radically transparent, that actually means nothing.
Yeah, that's a good summary of how choice might be exercised. We definitely don't want to interpret that as that technology will lay us bare to the world and we must just accept that. Yeah. Mega, perhaps you'd like to talk about some of your projects that you're working on at the moment, what your interests are, and how work is happening at the moment.
Yeah, Andy, thank you. So at the moment, you know, my personal and professional mission really is to advance the conversation about technology and the impact it'll have on our economy and our society. And I'm focusing on two key areas in there. So one is AI governance. That is something that I'm working with different companies on to help them be more confident in their AI strategy and avoid the pitfalls, think through some of the longer risk, longer term challenges. And the second part is thinking about integrated, holistic view of digital risk management so that we can simplify the complexity of digital resilience. Because as you know, as we've discussed throughout this show, technology is developing at lightning speed and we are using it everywhere all day. Cybersecurity attacks are rapidly evolving and it's hard enough to stay one step ahead of technology. It's even harder to stay one step ahead of all the criminals whose only purpose in life is to harm us. The laws and digital regulations are either in flux or they are still developing or they are in conflict with each other. And geopolitics is becoming this sort of constant barrage of bad news and uncertainty. So any company or small organization trying to be digitally resilient can very easily be overwhelmed by the scale of the challenge, its complexity. So I'm trying to simplify that complexity so that we can break down risk management into manageable chunks, you know, so that we can actually take some sober decisions, even if everything around us is in flux. So those are the two ways in which AI strategy, specifically AI governance and integrated digital risk management, are the two key ways in which I hope that over the coming years, I will be able to empower both organizations and individuals to become more vocal stakeholders in this space.
That all sounds terribly easy. It's not as if you've got your work cut out for you. That's a great summary of your project there, Mega. Do you have a personal website?
I'm working on a new one right now. Watch this space is all I'll say.
Okay, great. We'll leave that there. Helen, I think you're probably dying to come back in on Grok and stuff. We were chatting about it the other day, weren't we?
We were, yeah. Well, yeah, we were talking about how other applications won't let you access nudity. So if you look on OpenAI or anything like that, Microsoft's versions, they don't let you put nudity in. They don't let you remove clothes. It will just say, I can't do that. So how do we regulate companies that haven't built in those ring fences on a worldwide scale?
You know, the technical controls for that already exist, right? So that is why one model won't answer certain questions, won't generate certain kinds of content. Community guidelines already exist. I don't need to reinvent this wheel for Grok or anybody else. And, you know, Musk knows all too well how to do that. You know, I think the decision to allow Grok to do a lot more than other similar tools is embedded in his own view on free speech and highly libertarian idea of how he sees the world and what it should be. The issue is not technical or regulatory. It is about the inability of a senior, successful technologist to push his ideology through his tool.
Oh, yeah, we all see that. But when it comes to the court case, this is the conversation that me and Andy were having. Obviously, they've gone in and they've taken a lot of the files. They're going to investigate that, work out what happened. And potentially it is coming from, you know, one leader in the company. But what about the software engineers that coded that? What about the people that were aware that those ring fences weren't put in and carried on going to work and carried on making the product?
Yeah, well, you know, this has been a very interesting space, really, because while unionization has fallen across all sectors everywhere in the world, pretty much, what we have seen within large tech companies is this degree of employee activism. You know, we've had that at Google, for example, where Google employees pressured the leadership of the company to not sign certain contracts with the U.S. Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. We have had similar challenges within Facebook, when it was called Facebook, about the highly addictive nature of Facebook's algorithms. We have had, obviously, workers lobbying for better pay and better conditions at Amazon. So it is not true that employees within tech companies don't complain or don't raise their hands when something goes wrong. What is true, however, that despite those, very often companies don't change their view, right? And why might that be? Well, people are prioritizing their job security over something else. It is not, you know, sometimes people actually do quit their jobs, as senior AI researchers have done, right? So sometimes people are willing to stake their own personal lives because the idea or the objection matters more. But in most of these cases, you know, it's the unwillingness of a lot of technologists to see how what they're contributing to is creating a damaging hole. If you go back about 70, 80 years, a lot of the scientists who worked on nuclear technology, they couldn't see what they were building. Many of the more senior scientists, Oppenheimer, they knew exactly what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, for them, the cost-benefit analysis led them in one direction as opposed to another. But yeah, I mean, we will always need humanist technologists, just like we will need technologists who are willing to take good risks.
So we need to make sure that the ethics in computing is absolutely fundamental as a pillar, as a foundation of that learning that we then take into our professions.
Yes, and I think some structural choices can facilitate that in terms of, you know, making sure that people we recruit come from a diversity of backgrounds, mm-hmm. and they hold different ideas, they have had slightly different life experiences. So hopefully when they are ideating about a new tool, new feature or something, actually all kinds of stakeholders that we've been talking about, their voices are reflected at the design stage, at the fundamental design stage. You want everybody's views to be reflected. But what we're seeing more and more within these very tightly knit Silicon Valley circles is that it's the same people, very similar demographic, very similar educational backgrounds, very similar histories, who are building this tech. So how could you possibly have a diversity of thought when the people who are making it are so homogenous?
Helen, we'll tell you a little bit about the BCS, the British Computer Society. We're hoping to take back tech away from that Silicon Valley culture, that mentality, with the European sovereignty and UK sovereignty more and more. The British Computer Society play a role in that. And I embarked on writing a book called Ethics for Hackers. That's over 7 years ago now. And in the end, I kind of abandoned that project because really the world is just moving too fast. But also, you know, I resigned from academia on ethical grounds after 30 years of teaching, because cybersecurity really was becoming something that is working against security. But Helen, what are some, how does a BCS feature in this, and how can it help recruit more ethical developers?
It's a group of members. We all sign up, we all contribute, and it operates in most countries now in the world. And it's actually the leading body for ethics in technology. So everybody signs up, including companies. There are some big companies as well that have signed up. Google's one of them. And you basically agree as a professional, as an individual who works in that environment, that you're going to adhere to certain things. And you certainly, under those agreements, would have walked out from something like Grok development pretty early on. And actually, part of that is raising the flag and actually whistleblowing. And you get get protection. And it's about diversity as well, because something amazing happens when you get a bunch of diverse people in a room. You actually find that you have a lot more similarities and a lot more agreement than you think you would. You actually have more disagreement with people who are similar to you than you do with diverse groups. And it's amazing watching all these people from around the world meet in the same place to talk about one particular subject and all coming to the same conclusion. And it's all built around ethics. I think we need to really grow that outward as well.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a fascinating initiative. I will look more into this. And I think the opposite also needs to happen, which is that people who come from a humanities background, I think, should study technology and STEM subjects a lot more deeply than they do. One, because I think if they don't understand the technology, it'll be harder for them to sort of critically evaluate where a tech development is breaching some ethical principles. But equally, you have to understand the tech in order to own your role in it. You know, what kind of a stakeholder are you, and what kind of responsibilities and obligations therefore fall on you as a consumer of that technology or as a purveyor or whatever. And I think people also need to have a more scientific temperament, I think, and that comes when we understand both humanities and sciences in tandem with each other, so that we can think through political propaganda much more carefully, and we can sort of listen out for evidence and for facts, and sort of look past some of the political bluster that crowds our feeds.
An interesting contribution to that project of bringing power back as participatory technology, not as a consumer, or, you know, the word user is often seen as very kind of pejorative, is the importance of the free open software movement, which kind of dissolves that barrier between a user and a purveyor, in which, you know, we all become much more involved in the development of technology. And that requires digital technology to be structured in a certain way, in a modular, reusable way. And so that has implications in software engineering of how we build software, because in order to build software together and all have more of a stake in it rather than it being manufactured in big centralized factories, it requires education and it requires certain structuring of software engineering. Yeah.
You know, again, that is not a simple catch-all solution either. We saw that good, bad, and ugly in the world of cryptocurrency. The kind of decentralization of finance sort of made sense to a lot of people. It, to some extent, yes, it does democratize access. It creates a more shared ecosystem of financial transactions that, you know, the world pretty much runs on. The same is true for open source.
I don't see that same negative side. There are very, very, very few cases, in my experience, over 30 or 40 years of bad open source software, of malicious open source software. You know, obviously there are viruses and malware and things, but that wouldn't. What I do see in, with regard to security and free open source software, is that we have a maxim of trust but verify. And the ability to verify is absolutely central. If we wish to have cybersecurity in the future, we have to have free open source software, because there's no other alternative which allows security, even in principle. So that's a strong case for it.
Open source AI tool, in terms of their capabilities, are very close to matching proprietary tools, which is a great thing. But again, we have to make sure that intentional bad actors don't misuse that technology, because the barriers to misusing are just as low.
They are indeed. And that comes back to that, those comments about strategic limitation of knowledge and versus radical transparency.
Yeah.
One of the great challenges is how we are going to contain some models and how we're going to police those, because I think it's going to be necessary to have law enforcement and so on involved.
Yeah, but I just don't see how we crack the containment problem, you know, even for the last generation of containment problems, whether it was enriched uranium or a deadly pathogen that was stored in the highest security labs in the world. You know, the risk of operating at this cutting edge of technology means that containment almost always is imperfect.
Yeah, I'll just sing the praises of those people who probably don't get a lot of light shone on them, who do work on things like, you know, managing nuclear materials and, the guys at Porton Down and things like that. These are people who take what they do very, very seriously. Fortunately, they're very well funded. But what I worry about in a fragmenting world with the way that America's going and things like that now is that, and as things more dangerous, very high risk ventures go into the commercial private domain, that we're going to lose those abilities to contain things and police them.
Yeah, and I think here, the geopolitical ruptures of the world matter even more. Now, you know, one of the fascinating things about China, and I've been a China watcher on tech issues for a while, China, because of its political structure and the power of the Communist Party, is always incentivized to think long-term about digital risks. And almost all the risks that China identified good 10, 15 years ago on social media, on unfettered internet access, more recently on AI, you know, all the risks that they identified were actually spot on. But the solutions that they came up with are obviously not palatable to any democratic setting. China's taken a lot more state-controlled view of things than anywhere else in the world. That is not a democratic way of doing things. But there is a lot that a dialogue between the West and China could deliver for all of us because the risks are shared. How we go about solving them for our own political context is a second question. But in terms of our shared understanding of risks, we absolutely should be talking to each other.
Yeah, this is a very, very good point, a very good observation indeed, Megha. And I have noticed that, you know, that obviously China's demonized for its implementations and its authoritarianism, but it's certainly not taking its eye off the ball on risks. And there is this problem. I think it's a problem for all of us. It's called the Cassandra syndrome. If you are prescient and you see things coming, you're always on the back foot and you will always kind of have to take the accusation of being a pessimist. I mean, the current word bandied about now is Luddite, you know, and so on. This is a psychological problem, but it's also a political problem, is that people who are cautious and think more about risk and opportunity tend to be left out of the conversation or demonized.
And I think I have always throughout my career believed or tried to be a healthy skeptic. You know, I'm neither over optimistic nor overly pessimistic. I don't want to be an evangelist for one side or the other. It's an old-fashioned stoic virtue of temperance, of thinking through things slowly in a sober way. I appreciate that that's not the fashion anymore. Actually, it's these time-tested virtues that would serve us rather well right now. I think that, you'll not be surprised that this is what I'm recommending, but I think if people read more history, they would be more easily able to take a sober view of the future. Plus ça change, plus la même chose.
I would love to continue that conversation another day, Megha. It's been an absolute delight talking to you. We've covered so much ground.
You know, one of the projects that I didn't talk about is I want to start my own podcast. Once it's up and running, I'll let you know. It's called Real Feminism. Awesome. And the idea is very simple. Bringing together people from all walks of life, professionals, doctors, artists, writers, blah, 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 who are feminists at work and feminists at home.
Yeah, I'm the only female in a house of four men.
Sandy, this has been great fun.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us, Megha. It's been amazing talking to you today about history, politics, and tech and where that all fits in.
You're listening to The Cyber Show.